Let's Talk Pets.
Let's Talk Pets.
On Pet Life Radio.
Pet Life Radio.
PetLifeRadio.com.
This episode of Aquariumania is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at audiblepodcast.com/Aquariumania. Over 75,000 titles to choose from for your iPod or MP3 player.
Welcome to Aquariumania on Pet Life Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Roy Anong, speaking to you from the University of Florida's Tropical Aquaculture Laboratory in Ruskin, Florida. Thanks for joining us. So what is the biggest and baddest aquarium you've ever seen? How about the biggest and baddest fish? Best-selling author Steve Alton blows all of those out of the water with his latest sci-fi horror novel, Meg, Hell's Aquarium. In this fourth installment of Alton's Meg series, we learn more about Carcharodon megalodon, Meg for short, the enormous prehistoric relative of the great white shark, and what could happen if Megs were still around prowling the oceans or captive at some of the largest aquaria in the world. Join us as we talk with Steve about Megs and mega aquaria, other denizens of the deep water Philippine sea plate, Bond 007 girls, and his Adopt an Author program for teen readers. We'll be right back after these messages.
We'll be right back, right after these messages. Stay tuned.
Hey, boy, how you doing? What am I doing? I'm creating your own life book. It's a website that's just for you. Remember that picture I took of you pulling off Lisa's bathing suit? Yeah, I know, me too. I'm putting that awesome picture on your lifebook page. We'll see what comments we get. And that great video we took of you standing on the table with your head inside the turkey? That's definitely going on there. No, it's easy. It only took me 2 minutes to set up your page. I chose a great theme, and I can connect with millions of other pet parents. I can also create a memorial lifebook. No, not for Grandma. But we can make one for Fluffy, remember her? And we can even put links to our favorite pet charity. And friends can make donations. People can create their own life book for their pets by going to PetLifeRadio.LivingYearsPets.com. Or they can sign up on the Pet Life Radio homepage. Where's Lisa? She's outside by the pool. Hey, come back here! Create your own life book for your pet. PetLifeRadio.LivingYearsPets.com.
Coast to coast and around the world, it's All Behave with Arden Moore. Find out why cats and dogs do the things they do and get the latest buzz from wagging tongues and tails in Rin Tin Tinseltown. From famous pet experts and best-selling authors to television and movie stars, you'll get great tail-wagging pet tips and have a fur-flying fun time. All Behave with America's pet edutainer, Arden Moore. Every week on demand, this is the place for a special paparazzi treat, only on PetLifeRadio.com. Let's Talk Pets on PetLifeRadio.com.
Welcome back to Aquariumania on Pet Life Radio. My guest today is Steve Alton, best-selling author of Hell's Aquarium. Hi, Steve. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So I really flew through Hell's Aquarium, and it was an incredible ride. I have to ask, before we even start talking about the book, have you always had an interest in marine biology?
I've always been interested in sea creatures, and especially when I was growing up, loved to read about prehistoric sea monsters or great white shark attacks, and there was always a blurb about megalodon, but never much other than an old Smithsonian picture of six nerdy-looking scientists sitting in this giant jaw. And then when I was 35 and looking for a change in careers, and I decided to write a book, I sort of tapped my teenage years.
So What is Meg and Hell's Aquarium all about for the listeners who haven't actually had a chance to read it yet?
Well, Meg, Hell's Aquarium is the fourth and best in the Meg series, and Meg stand is short for Carcharodon megalodon, the 70-foot, 70,000-pound prehistoric cousin of the great white shark. And megalodon was a real creature. It inhabited all the oceans, and we find their teeth in phosphate pits in South Florida. They used to be covered by ocean.
Now, in the book, you kind of talk a little bit about potential for these things to actually still be around. Could megalodon actually be alive today?
Well, the thing about the oceans is that they cover 70% of the planet, and we've only explored about 5% of the ocean and less than 1% of the deep waters. So, you know, we really don't know what's down there, and megalodon is not like a T-Rex that disappeared 65 million years ago. They only disappeared anywhere from 10,000 to 100,000 years ago, depending upon who you ask. And so it's possible these creatures, or at least some of them, could have gone into deeper waters.
What other monsters do you discuss and are featured in Meg, Hell's Aquarium?
Well, in Meg, Hell's Aquarium, I sort of, wanted to bring back all the scariest sea monsters that ever inhabited the planet. And to do that, I created an ancient sea beneath the Philippine Sea Plate, which is a mysterious sea plate in itself. It's where all the Mariana Trench and the other deep water trenches are located. And in this Panthalassa Sea, which dates back 220 million years, we've got everything from Leoplorodon to Mosasaurs to Dunkleosteus. And, you know, if it swam in the ocean and it had big teeth and it was big, it's probably in the book.
So what are your thoughts on any of these being around, Carcharodon?
Well, with Carcharodon megalodon, there's a much greater chance. With some of these other prehistoric sea monsters, not as likely. You know, that's where we stretch the fiction a little bit. But with megalodon, yeah, I mean, you never know what's down there.
So you mentioned the Philippine Sea Plate, and obviously that played a major part in the book. How did you come up with the idea of using that, the Philippine Sea Plate, and kind of the mystique around it for sort of the action?
Well, throughout the Meg series, the Mariana Trench plays an integral part, because this is a 7-mile deep, 1,500-mile long, unexplored gorge at the bottom. And, you know, hydrothermal vents at the bottom of the ocean spring life into this deep water abyss. The Mariana Trench is located at the Philippine Sea Plate. And the Philippine Sea Plate itself is a small plate that's being pushed from all sides, and it's actually, the borders of it are trenches themselves, including the Mariana Trench. So I thought, you know, this would be a pretty neat place to do it. I just have to have a reason that's scientifically based that this prehistoric ocean could exist. And so in doing research, I managed to find three doctoral students in Australia who are now scientists, and they had done a study on the Philippine Sea Plate and its unusual depths and contours. And so I contacted them, and we sort of worked out a scientific basis for this Panthalassa Ocean, Panthalassa Sea, to be in existence.
Had they done any deep sea studies down there themselves? Had they seen anything kind of interesting, as well as kind of working the science out with you?
Yeah, they found that the sea plate itself was divided into different sections, and some of them were far older than the others, and that sort of played into my scientific aspect of how there could be this long-lost ancient sea down there. So that worked out really well, and they also lent me use of their topography images, and which I included in the book so readers can get an understanding of how it works.
Yeah, that actually did help me quite a bit. I'm kind of more of a visual person as well, so I did appreciate those. Now, this summer marks the 35th anniversary of Jaws. How much, obviously there was Jaws influence in this, but how much would you say Jaws played in your, I guess, desire to kind of write the book, as well as in parts of the book that you were penning out?
Well, as a teenager, when I was reading Jaws back in 74, 75, you know, that was a major influence in wanting to know more about great white sharks. And Jaws was sort of the springboard into doing research on shark attacks and understanding how great whites worked. And so I'd say it was a pretty strong influence. Also, when I sat down to write Meg, the original of the four books in 1995, I was determined that, the one thing I loved about Jaws was the shark attack scenes. And then, you know, there was a plot involving all the other characters and, you know, Brody's wife cheating on him with Hooper and things like that. And I wasn't as much interested in that aspect. I wanted to see more shark attack stuff. So, I made sure that when I wrote the Meg series that, you know, there was action in, you know, at least every chapter.
So I guess how would the shark in Jaws compare to Meg?
The shark in Jaws, the great white in Jaws, would just be basically a snack to a full-grown megalodon. And you just can't even compare the two. I mean, if you think of what a megalodon is, it's a great white the size of two greyhound buses back-to-back, and that's just a big fish.
Now, you mentioned in the book and also in the acknowledgments, the Georgia Aquarium, and, you know, I did notice kind of parallels with their whale shark exhibit and all the things that went into collecting, housing, that sort of thing. Can you tell us how they helped you out in your background research and what kind of ideas you got from that with regard to kind of these, you know, mega fauna?
Yeah, I was fortunate enough that when I was writing Hell's Aquarium, I was contacted by a PBS guy in Atlanta, Georgia, who was actually wanting to do a story on the Shell Game, which is my book about the end of oil and the next 9/11 event. And I asked him if he had any contacts in the Georgia Aquarium. He said he did. And so we arranged, when I was up there doing the interview, for a sort of a backstage tour of everything. And they brought me back into the tanks and the filtration systems, and they taught me how everything worked, and I took extensive notes so that in transferring that information to Hell's Aquarium, you know, there's part of the plot involves a facility in Monterey called the Tanaka Institute, which is this huge aquarium that houses these megalodons. And so the Georgia tour was really an integral part of my education on how aquariums work, and not only did I learn a lot, but I was able to sort of break down the information to the average reader.
And I think even in terms of like the transport, it sounded like you kind of had a pretty good feel on, you know, what would be involved with transporting. Did they talk with you about transport at all? How did you get all that?
Yeah, they did, and I sort of extrapolated that information to transporting two megalodon pups, which are actually a little bigger than what a full-grown juvenile whale shark would be.
I guess in terms of aquariums, do you think an aquarium would be able to keep a megalodon successfully if there really was one, or do you think that would be something that would be really tricky?
Well, it's hard to keep great whites in captivity. Monterey was able to do it for a short amount, but the tank that they kept it in wasn't built for a great white. You know, great whites are going to be sensitive to metal and other materials in the tank. The tank's got, if the tank is big enough, then I don't think there's a problem keeping it. You know, with a megalodon, you can have a pretty big tank and you can still see the shark moving through the water. With a great white, you know, they tend to put them in these small tanks to appease visitors, but it's not necessarily very good for the fish. I think it's possible that you could keep a megalodon in captivity if you were able to capture one, but the tank would have to be huge. And that's part of the problem in Hell's Aquarium, that they've got two tanks. They've got this huge lake-sized facility for Angel, which is the 70-footer, and the offspring are all kept in a small meg pen, and they're sort of, it's much too small for them.
So I guess when, maybe going back to the first Meg book, when you were writing these, did you have a feel for kind of like the big storyline, the big picture? And I guess you're working on a fifth book in the Meg series now, or did you sort of have each book kind of, you know, at a time when you were developing the stories?
Well, I never imagined that it would go four deep. I figured I'd stop at two, but then I came back to the series later on and set up for some pretty interesting sequels. So, but yeah, I mean, each book, you know, is sort of encapsulated as its own story. You can read them separately, or you can follow them one through four.
Now, a lot of the book I really enjoyed, you had a lot of kind of current appeal and relevance, and even some of the things your characters would say about various things, you know, including like Dubai. When you included Dubai in the book, how did you research this, and did you have a chance to go over there or, you know, speak with folks in Dubai?
No, I just don't have the time or budget to do that. I mean, the information on the internet is pretty extensive about Dubai, and what I needed to know is a little bit about the culture and how they build things out there, and just the mentality of, you know, that they're trying to be the biggest and the best of everything they do, and they put that effort into all their hotels, and they put it into their amusement parks, and so it seemed like the perfect setting to create this Disney World-like aquarium-themed park. And, you know, I really enjoyed designing it because I think that if it existed, I'd want to go see it.
Yeah, definitely, me too. It was actually interesting, too, you know, because they had that recent, I guess, major leak over in Dubai. So, obviously, it wouldn't have been your design if it leaked like they had over there. But there was, I don't know, you saw the video, right, on that for the major leak over there?
No, I didn't.
Yeah.
That was an aquarium?
Yeah, at the mall. Yeah, the Dubai Aquarium Mall had a major leak. So there's actually on YouTube, there's a video of the water kind of just, I think, ankle deep in some areas. But when I was reading the Dubai part, I was kind of laughing. I didn't know if you had that intended, but it was there. So that was kind of cute. Now, you also raised some really good questions about keeping kind of large, more difficult aquatic species in captivity. You know, some of these maybe, you know, you intended on purpose, and maybe some were just kind of a follow-up.
Well, I know I'd be doing your show a year later, so I should advise this.
Exactly. So I guess, you know, we talked a little bit about, you know, the size limitations. You know, for some species, what would be some maybe factors you would think about, you know, for or against, you know, whether we're talking about size or maybe population structure, you know, being endangered, non-endangered? What are your kind of thoughts on that, since you sort of bring that up a little bit in the book?
Well, I think most of the information comes from the Georgia Aquarium, what they provided me on their backstage tour. And you know, they've got, you wouldn't think it, but aquariums have to have different currents in them. And so they create these artificial currents so the fish can swim with the current and swim against it. You know, a fish as large as a whale shark, or, you know, in the extreme cases, a megalodon, would need, you know, a habitat that offered a variety of different aspects of the ocean, gradient temperatures, the proper lighting, the proper, obviously, the mixture in the water so that's, you know, as pure as possible, because, you know, these animals are defecating in their own tanks, and not only does it have to be filtered, but, you know, it has to be super clean because they're drinking their own water, and the ocean sort of takes care of it itself. But, you know, all these factors go into building an aquarium, and for the average person, you don't realize that you're just looking at a big tank filled with water with fish in it, but there really is a lot more built into the tank. They have ultraviolet lights that emulate the sun's rays, and they've got other aspects that you just wouldn't think about.
Yeah, no, that's definitely true. Well, I've got more questions for you, but let's take a short break to hear from our sponsors and then continue our discussion of Hell's Aquarium with best-selling author Steve Alton right after these messages.
We'll be right back right after these messages. Stay tuned.
Hey, love to read, but just never seem to have enough time to sit in one place long enough? For all of us on-the-go people, Audible has the answer. Best-selling audiobooks for your iPod or MP3 player. For Pet Life Radio listeners, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 14-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. Choose from hundreds of today's bestsellers, including awesome pet books such as Bad Dogs Have More Fun by Marley and the author John Grogan, Love That Cat by Ingrid Newkirk, It's Okay to Miss the Bed on the First Jump, and Other Life Lessons I Learned from Dogs by Seinfeld's John O'Hurley, and many, many more. To download your free audiobook today, go to audiblepodcast.com/aquariumania. Again, that's audiblepodcast.com/aquariumania for your free audiobook.
It's time for school for you and your friends, your furry best friends. Train your dog the fun and easy way with Teacher's Pet Sessions. Teacher's Pet host Pia Silvani teaches you step-by-step how to train your dog the fun and easy way. You get 8 30-minute live audio training sessions, complete transcripts of each session, plus a basic training manual to get you and your dog off to a great start. Training begins the moment you bring your dog home. Teacher's Pet Sessions offers positive reinforcement training to shape your dog's behavior and encourages upbeat, enthusiastic responses to ensure that your dog will enjoy learning. Teacher's Pet Sessions dog training is fun at both ends of the leash. So listen, learn, and laugh with your dog with Teacher's Pet Sessions. Get your copy of Teacher's Pet Sessions Volume 1 today. To order, go to teacherspetsessions.com.
Hi, this is Pia Silvani, your host. Bring your dog, tug toy, and treats, and get ready to have some fun.
teacherspetsessions.com.
Pet Life Radio presents Paranormal Pets, where you can always expect the unexpected. Each week we'll discuss all aspects of weird or spiritual animal encounters, ghosts, totems, psychic animals, animal souls, animal angels, and animals in religion, with a little cryptozoology thrown in. Step into the supernatural world of pets with your Paranormal Pets ghostly host, Dusty Rainbolt, every week on demand, only on PetLifeRadio.com.
Let's talk pets
on Pet Life Radio.
PetLifeRadio.com.
We're back. And continuing our conversation with my guest, best-selling author, Steve Alton. Now, in the book, Steve, going back to kind of some of the more cool stuff you had as well, you mentioned one thing I noticed was your kind of discussion, real brief, on DARPA, and they're interested in training sharks for the military. Where did you get that idea to put that in there, and have you any more info on that sort of thing?
Well, I'd run across that information earlier, and DARPA and, you know, other agencies like the CIA are trying to use sharks and dolphins as means of mind detecting and God knows what else that we don't know about. And sort of played a small part in Meg Hell's Aquarium, but not a big one. I think it was the background of one of the shark experts that they brought in to understand what was going on with the megalodons.
Yeah, I think I was doing a little quick check, too, and I guess based on kind of that implant they were using in the shark to sort of get them to...
Right, yeah, that was all based on real science. They actually are implanting these little receptors into sharks' brains and stimulating their senses so that they actually can, you know, almost zombie sharks that they're controlling.
I thought that was pretty cool. Going back to kind of the high-tech stuff you included, what were your inspirations
That's our taxpayer money at work, by the way.
Yeah, exactly. DARPA
that's
has a lot
stuff
of things
that you don't see in that big Pentagon budget.
That's right. Or you have to really know somebody or read between the lines or something. In terms of some more of the kind of cool tech stuff you brought into it, what were your inspirations for the submersibles? You had some, you know, obviously the cool submersibles in the first book, and then you included some additional ones in Hell's Aquarium.
Well, when I create submersibles, it's got to be scientifically plausible based on real science, and it also has to be something that's visually fun and something that if I was piloting a submersible, this is what I would want out of it. So in the first book, the first and second book, Meg, the Abyss Gliders were more torpedoes with wings, small wings, which increased the claustrophobic effect. In Hell's Aquarium, the subs have evolved into something that's more designed like the shape of a stingray. And, you know, the stingrays are much more hydrodynamic in shape. And what I did was I took the information that I had come up with and sent it to a forensic artist who has worked on developing vessels for designs. He's an artist. So I had him design the craft and worked with him. And I actually, you know, I put pictures of these things in the book because, yeah, it's fun to do for the reader, but it gives them a better understanding of what these things look like.
Yeah, I definitely like, you know, the diagrams, but, and also when you had kind of the huge sea monsters and then the little tiny watercraft right next to them, that was kind of good for scale. Now, Lana Wood, you know, the Bond actress, being in Meg Hell's Aquarium, how did that all happen? What made you decide to put her in there?
Well, all the characters in my books are actually real people who have sent me bios and descriptions of themselves and entered contests that I have every couple months on my monthly newsletters. And so it's sort of my way of giving readers opportunities to immortalize themselves in the books. And it makes it easier for me because I don't have to come up with these. You know, after a while, it's tough to come up with names and descriptions of minor characters. I mean, each book might have 60 of them. So by opening up to the readers, it's a lot more fun for me, and they give me information that's much more interesting. And I try to curb the storyline to fit their particular description. I was in the middle of writing Meg Hell's Aquarium when I received an email from Lana Wood, who played Plenty O'Toole in Diamonds Are Forever. And I'm a big Bond fan. I read the books when I was growing up, and I loved all the movies, and especially the earlier ones. And it turns out that Lana Wood is a fan of my Meg series, and her grandson is a huge shark fan. And she had a simple request, and that is, could she be a character in the book? Well, of course, absolutely. Lana Wood. And so we exchanged phone numbers, and we called each other up, and we talked and became friends. And I created a scene for her. And, you know, her only request was that it was just going to be a vicious scene. And it's a little, you know, you have to understand that writing this scene, Lana Wood's older sister, Natalie Wood, drowned.
Right.
You know, in the same boat with Robert Wagner. And, you know, and there was all sorts of accusations going on. And so to kill her sister off, even in the pages, was a little strange. And so when I finished the scene, I sent it to Lana and I said, listen, I just want to make sure you're okay with this because it's really violent. And she loved it. And later on in the year after the hardback came out, we flew Lana and her grandson into Arizona where they housed the largest megalodon jaw in the world, which is about 10 feet high. And it's filled with real teeth, some of which are over 7 inches. And we took a photo shoot and a video shoot with Lana in the jaws. So it really worked out well.
That is great. I assume she, I wonder if she would have been happy if you killed off her grandson too. They might have been going over a little bit too much over the line, possibly.
I don't want to spoil it for the readers.
Yeah, sorry about that. Yep. Now, since you mentioned that, I actually was wondering about any of the other characters. Were any of the other characters in Hell's Aquarium, or can you mention a couple other characters in there that were from readers?
Well, except for the couple of the major characters, they're all readers. And, for instance, I had a reader who lost both of his legs. I don't know if it was to diabetes or something like that. But and so I put him as a character, and in the storyline, he loses both of his legs. You know, to Angel, the megalodon who bites him off, and so he loved that. Yeah, I mean, he just loved that because, you know, now he's telling his friends that he lost his legs in a shark attack.
Exactly,
more interesting. So those are the things I try to do when people have certain things going on with them in their lives. If, for instance, I'm writing a book now, which is the third in the Domain series, my Mayan calendar story, and I have a character in there who has emailed me many times. His wife emails me for him because he's blind and he's a diver. And you know, so I put him in a story, but his character is blind just like he is. So I tried not to change the characters, the actual readers' descriptions. I just try to work them into the story, and it, you know, makes for more in-depth minor character.
Now, do you use their real names usually, or do you change?
Oh yeah. 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 I mean, that's the point.
Oh, that's great. So I'll have to send you a little bio to get in the next book then. Is that what you're saying?
There you go.
So I have seen you.
Do you want me to kill you in the story or keep you alive?
I don't know. Well, it depends. If you're going to do a couple more, you may have to. I guess.
I asked that, you know,
question.
It's not like a tongue-in-cheek question because whenever I do a character contest for the Meg books, the overwhelming majority of people who enter the contest are desperately requesting that I kill them. And it's just a bizarre thing. Here these readers are just, it's sort of like become a status. So
probably
kill everybody. I mean, I said, well, what if you died of syphilis or something like that?
Nice. Probably if you asked that.
That wouldn't be as attractive. Need to die by a shark.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, now that you put it that way, probably if you had asked readers to do this 30 years ago, I wonder if the same number would be wanting to get killed off. It's almost kind of a cultural thing now. But yeah, I think if I did die, I want it to be for some like great, you know, like Spockish kind of
great heroic, huh?
Exactly, like Spock, you know. But then I come back, of course. So going through the internet and some of the articles, now I've heard that a Meg movie's kind of been in the works for like, what, 8-9 years or so? Is that right? And what's the status of the Meg movie? I know that's sort of, a lot of people are wondering about that.
Well, the story with the Meg movie, that the movie was actually optioned before the book was published. We had a first look deal at Disney's Hollywood Pictures. They snatched it up and unfortunately, they went through two really bad scripts, and then the president of Hollywood Pictures was fired. And when a president's fired, the incoming president doesn't touch any of his projects because that would only make the last guy look good. So the rights reverted back to us after a year, and then it was optioned by New Line Cinema in 2005, and we had Jan de Bond attached as director. We had a bunch of high-level producers attached, and we had a script that Jan and I had worked on together. Well, they didn't want this script. They wanted to work with another screenwriter, Shane Salerno, and Shane basically rewrote Moby Dick, the big shark, and it just didn't work, and they returned the property to us after a couple of years, and now we've completed financing. We're doing it privately. We've completed private financing for a $150 million movie, and you know, we're taking it out to studios and directors right now. And I wrote a new script parallel to the book, only it's a more modern version of it.
Okay. So I guess you can't really give a prediction, but if you were forced to under pain of shark attack or something, what would your prediction be for when we may see a movie?
Probably summer 2012.
Okay. No, that's great. Yeah, I mean, I guess some of your folks had done some of those trailers, and you know, the trailers themselves are great. I'm definitely looking forward to seeing that, and I know a lot of people, you know, will be as well. Now, I read a lot about your Adopt an Author program as well. Can you talk a little bit about that program?
Yeah, about, I guess it's been about 10 years ago, right after May came out, I became inundated with emails from teenagers who were all telling me the same thing. You know, Steve, I hate reading, but I loved reading Meg, you know, and I want to read more books like this. And then I started getting email from teachers across the country who were telling me that they were actually using Meg in the classroom in high schools because it was getting their students to read. And then I found out that the Young Adult Library Services Association had selected Meg as the number one book for reluctant readers. And the book isn't written for teens. It's an adult book. But it was getting teens to read. And it was the subject matter because it's a fast-moving story. I mean, there's no dull parts in any of my books. They move pretty fast. So I realized that something good was happening. And my background's in education. I have a bachelor's, master's, and doctorate degree in education. I'm certified to teach in high school. And so what I did was I put together a nonprofit program called Adopt an Author. And Adopt an Author is essentially a program that offers teachers free curriculum materials, projects, tests, quizzes, study guides, everything they could possibly use, a pool of materials to develop curriculums. And in the process of reading the story, the students can email me, and I email them back. And then at the end of the unit, we do either a conference call into the classroom where I can visit the classroom if it's, you know, close, you know, to my home in Florida. And over the years, I've visited over 100 schools and have communicated with probably 1,000 more. And the program has grown from 10 high schools in 1999 to over 10,000 registered teachers. So it's really blossomed that, you know, we have other authors involved too, but, you know, my books are the main thrust of the story of the program, and it gets teens to read. And the secret behind the program is really simple. It's if you make reading fun, then people will read. And so it's the subject matter. And what surprised me is that, you know, teachers in English class and reading class were using the same books that they used when I was in high school. I mean, Romeo and Juliet, The Scarlet Letter, Wuthering Heights. I mean, you know,
right.
Nothing wrong against the, you know, when somebody
exactly.
says
the classics.
Classic to me,
right. Yeah.
You know, it means that it's just old and they're so ingrained in using the same curriculum rather than coming up with something new. So that, you know, when we developed the program, I wanted to make sure that the teachers had curriculum materials so there wouldn't be an excuse not to use the program because they had to actually develop their own. We have all the teachers pull their materials into one, you know, website, and then they could pick and choose what they like.
It's definitely a great idea, and you're right, and I agree. There's definitely room for classics, but if the kids aren't reading, or if it's turning them away from reading, then there's definitely has to be some sort of change in approach. Have any of your teen readers expressed an interest in marine biology or paleobiology?
Oh yeah, absolutely. In fact, there are as many science teachers using the book as there are English teachers, and I get a lot of email from students who say they're going to college for marine biology, and pretty amazing, you know, just from reading a book, now they're interested in making it their career.
It's got to feel pretty good, though, I'm sure. It definitely, as an educator, I'm sure you appreciate that a lot. So what's next for you, then, in terms of, I know you're working on another book. I haven't gotten through some of your other series, and I need to do that, but what's kind of on your plate coming up?
Well, the biggest and best book that I've written is coming out on October 10th, and that's called Grim Reaper and the Days. And Grim Reaper is a series that parallels Dante's Inferno, and sort of a modern-day Dante's Inferno, and it takes place in New York City, and when a man-made biological plague is introduced into Manhattan, and the hero of the story, who's a veteran from the Iraqi War, has to travel across Manhattan through the nine layers of hell to the nine circles of hell to find his wife and child. And it's a very deep book. It took me 2 years to write it, and I'm just really happy with it.
I'm definitely looking forward to reading it. And you probably didn't even have to stretch New York as hell too much, I'm guessing.
Oh, well, you'd be surprised.
I'm kidding. Well, I appreciate your time. I definitely have a lot more questions for you, but unfortunately, we're out of time. I'd like to thank my guest, Steve Alton, our producers, especially Mark Winter, for making this show possible. Steve, did you have any final thoughts for our listeners?
Just that Meg Hell's Aquarium's on sale on paperback, and the hero of the story goes to the University of Florida, so there's even more reason for Gator fans to read the book.
Exactly. Go Gators, definitely. And I guess in one of the other books, they lived in Tampa for a while too, right, before they moved out?
Yes.
Well, thanks again, Steve, for joining us. Please be sure to check out Steve Alton's web pages. The links will be on his Aquarium Mania bio page. I encourage all of you to visit my Aquarium Mania blog on Pet Life Radio. You'll find additional pictures from different episodes as well as questions or comments that some of our listeners have. Also, if you have any questions, comments, or ideas for a show, email me at drroy, D-R-R-O-Y, at petliferadio.com. That's drroy at petliferadio.com. If you're ever in Florida, please be sure to visit the Aquarium Mania exhibit and the sharks at the Florida Aquarium in Tampa, one of my favorite aquariums. Until next time, please visit your local public aquariums and aquarium stores and keep your tanks clean and your fish healthy. And if you haven't had a chance to read Hell's Aquarium or any of Steve Alton's other books, please put them on your mandatory reading list.
Let's Talk Pets, every week on demand, only on PetLifeRadio.com.